The campus cat had many names. Some called him Claw, some called him Mangeball, some called him Pest. There were some students on campus who called him Aslan and Bagpuss, Beelzebub or Brillo, Tinkerbell, Garfield, Pussy, Pusscat, Bosscat, Jazzycat, Kissycat, Squishycat, Mangycat, Smellycat, Kittycat, Whiskers, Gus. Let's be honest, when it came to the campus cat, some students came out with a lot of shit. Did the campus cat care? No, these were just sounds to him, noises the big things shouted or purred at him. He didn't need a name because he was a cat. No, he was the cat, the daddy cat. He was the fastest, strongest, leanest, meanest bird-catching cat around. But then again, he was the only cat around. There had been a time when the university was infested with the cats, his family, but hard winters and the castration program had wiped out his catty kin. He was the last. Morning for the campus cat started before dawn. That night he had slept in a corner of the halls of residence. The evening previously one of the students had let him in, fed him with processed ham, and then forgot about him. Unable to find a way out without the assistance of a big person, he sang gently to himself a cat song. There have been few studies of cat song. For obvious reasons. Most cat songs are very short, primarily because after the first verse, someone throws something at the singer. The campus cat knew that if he sang for long enough, someone would take pity and let him out, possibly after giving him some breakfast. Sure enough, in the early morning, the hall's cleaner arrived. She was a plump woman who was always insulted that the residents left things for her to clean. Look at this floor. What do they expect me to do with this? Every morning it's the same. We come and find the place I tip. Meow, said the cat. Ooh, said the cleaner, whose hand was already descending for a too vigorous neck-breaking cat pat. Good morning, kitty. How are you today? Did you sleep well? Do you want some breakfast? Meow. Good cat. Have you seen this mess?
Meow.
Pigs. A bunch of pigs.
Meow.
Oh, do you want to go out?
Meow.
And the cat was freed and free to re-explore the wilds of the campus. The university campus was a self-contained affair, built on the slopes of a hill without cloisters or airs of grandeur, nor even the solidarity of red brick. This university revelled in concrete. Grey and green lived, clung, hung on the eye. Some buildings inspirate awe, history, excitement or youth. This was architecture, architecture to inspire mould. Green loads and stale minds lit on dull days and dusky evenings with the light of computer monitors and faint drizzle. Onto these lonely paths of distanced learning, the campus cat trod with thoughts of the hunt. He wasn't hungry, but instinct compelled him to keep his skills sharp. His ears were scarred, he'd lost much of the fur down his right-hand side, his left eye was a little blind, but he was still on top form. Then he saw the bird. A bird. The cat's PlayStation. A feathered Xbox. It would keep him busy for a while. But just as the cat was about to pounce, he sensed danger, something wrong, something different. It wasn't a movement, it wasn't a sound, it was just a sense. A sense he and the bird obviously shared as it fluttered off with some speed. He pounced after it, but too late. Something had arrived. They were first seen in the sky. Aeroplane pilots reported strange lights, three glowing orbs travelling at amazing speed. They were the gods. Whose gods, we shall never know, for they used no names and were powerful enough to put off anyone asking. From the air, it was impossible to tell where they were heading, but we know. They were heading towards the campus of a university. This early morning in spring, these lights descended on various buildings on campus, one here, one there, one back there. And whatever they touched was changed. One of the gods floated down and landed outside the administration building. The cobbles at his feet grew a covering of carpet, plush and purple. Axminster. His simple tunic brushed the stem of a daffodil. He turned briefly to see the flower twist and buckle under the influence of his touch. It grew to a height of 5'4", pulled out its suspiciously leg-like roots, and stretched. "Good morning," said the daffodil politely, as it wandered into the students' union for a pint. And the god smiled, for it was good. The vice-chancellor was a thick-set man with a thick-set brain, but he wasn't stupid, just unsubtle. A spade was a spade and a brick was for throwing. He'd worked his way through management training like a commando in the Special Forces, only worse. He was the dirty hand-to-hand fighter of business school. If he saw a problem, he'd walk on it. If someone got in his way, he'd kick them where it hurts and blame someone else. If you didn't like what he planned to do, tough, because he'd go and do it anyway. On this particular day, he was looking out of his window on the fifth floor of the administration building. There was a light in the sky. He shook his head. He must have imagined it. Lights in the sky, not rational, not part of his action plan, and today was a busy day. The new computers were coming through, and there was a management meeting to discuss the future of the science course. What future? And the English department felt under attack. They were. Usually he hated such meetings. An hour with those sedentary academics was not his idea of fun. But when they heard about the planned management restructuring, his surface or polite managerial butchering, they would squirm appreciatively. Today was going to be his day. His smug satisfaction reverberated throughout down onto the forecourt. And the god looked up. A challenge. Meanwhile, in the English department, the day's business was beginning anew. The senior English literature lecturer had a day of tutorials for the Shakespeare module. Ah, Shakespeare module 101, glory be to the bard. The board outside his office was filled with names of hard-working students awaiting his wisdom. Engaged in the vital business of lighting his second fag of the day, he didn't notice the first name on the booking form on his door change. A knock. The door opens. The first student patters in. Patters. "Come in, how's the dissertation going?" His words froze on the tip of his tongue. There was an energy in the room. The brightness was unmissable. He looked up, and there she was. The most beautiful, luscious, ripest student he had ever seen. And she was naked. His gasp was almost audible. "I heard," she said, "it was traditional to make love to your pupils." He couldn't believe his ears. He barely believed his luck. Normally it took months to get this far. You had to blackmail them with promises of grades or get them drunk in the students' union before they gave out. Not since the 70s had he had an offer so blatant. He was not known as the lecturer for nothing. He got up. He moved towards her. They were millimetres apart. "Be warned," the naked student said. "If this is against the rules, I will have to punish you." Punish. He liked the sound of that. "It's not against the rules," he said, and kissed her. It was an acid brightness on his lips, a searing agony of light and touch and sound. "Liar!" she screamed, and the student body exploded into light. Blinded, the lecturer fell to the ground, terrified by the reveal of a goddess. The fearsome angel, fury itself, loomed over him. "You are dishonest, manipulative. Your smell of corruption hangs off these walls." Even in his crumpled worship of her power, the English lecturer couldn't help but wish for less purple in her passages. "Your lie can't go unpunished," she continued. "I will curse you. I curse you to perpetual attention."
"Perpetual attention? What's that?"
Andy looked down. "This is a curse?" he asked. "It's a miracle." At this the goddess smiled and disappeared. No sooner had she gone, but he was left looking at Sylvia and his first tutorial for Shakespeare Module 101 and the agony of desire. The goddess was as good as her word. In that flash, she had struck down the lecturer with the worst disease known to man, perpetual attention and a libido to match. Now, he'd been about the block a few times. Well, more than a few times. Look, sexually speaking, he'd given up looking for a parking space. And yet, generally, he found his interest in the opposite sex to be, at best, an occasional pastime, a perk of the job, a sleeping dragon to be poked only when needed, and suddenly everything was awake again in a very real sense. He tried to think about Shakespeare, but his mind, his other mind, refused to budge. His newly raised hormone level was in control. He couldn't resist. He had to try and kiss her. And the instant he did, the canoe capsized. "Thank God!" he cried, and she slapped him and ran off. But he didn't care. He was free from the curse. So with relief, he sat back in his chair. And it came back. There was no time to escape or shut his door, for in came his next duty. Another face he had to kiss. Again the submarine dives. Again he cries, "Thank God!" Again a slap, an exit, and again it comes back. Constant stimulation, no payoff. And the goddess watched and laughed and added more names to the list, a list of tutorials stretching into infinity, some of them human. "It'll be interesting," mutters the goddess under her breath, "what he'll do with the penguin." And she smiled, for it was good. The campus cat had been following a ball of light for 5 minutes. Whenever he got close, ready to pounce, it moved. He moved in again, and again it moved away. This time he stopped, hissed, and scrunched himself down. The ball of light seemed to consider him for a moment. It then moved closer to him. He hissed. It moved closer. It was as if it wanted to know what the cat was trying to say. The cat pounced, spun, and fell. Quick as he was, the light had gone. "Where did it go?" "Meow." "Odd thing. Something's wrong. That doesn't sound the same. I'm meow talking. Meow, like a... oh, I know this one. Human. I know things. I know things I didn't know. I'm different. I'm a cat. That's what they call me. I'm a cat on a university. How did I know that? I can talk. I can talk. No, no, this is not right. Cats don't talk. They meow. No one will accept me as a talking cat. I hunt. Hunt? I eat other creatures. I hunt, play with, kill, and devour the
raw flesh of another living creature. I've never thought that out before. I will become a vegetarian. A vegetarian cat who can talk. No, I could express myself perfectly well before. Me. Ow. Me. Oh. Me. Me, I can't do it. Who did this to me? I want to go back to the way I was.
But what was that? What is it to be a cat? I was born to be furry, to lick and clean, breed others of my kind. I didn't ask for this awareness. At this point, the cat's musings on the nature of existence were mercifully, as it turns out, cut short as a nail-chalk shriek rips through the air coming from the kitchen of the halls of residence where the cleaner is running out in terror and confusion. We backtrack. She was just starting to do the dishes when, yes, you've guessed it, a mysterious child appeared behind her and asked her what she was doing. He was so cute, she thought. Couldn't harm a fly. What am I doing, little boy? She bitter laughed. I'm cleaning up after all these students. They have no idea the effort I go to. They don't. They're pigs. Just pigs. You look at them and all I see are pigs. Turn them into pigs who would notice. The child looked at her with midwitch eyes, saying, is there anything I can do for you? Oh, there's nothing you can do. Nothing. Unless you can get the place to clean itself, there isn't anything you can do. The cleaner didn't see the boy, the god, smile. She didn't notice matter shift, the child's ready breck glow, or his quiet laugh. But she did notice when the kitchen went mad. No, not mad. Disney. The kitchen turned Disney, plates washing themselves, birds flying in with tea towels, squirrels with scouring pads on their feet, skating across the oven tops, and the big floor waxer manoeuvred by teams of badgers, squadrons of foxes standing on hind legs, uncoiled the vacuum cleaner, and hedgehogs made kamikaze attempts to unblock the drains. As if that wasn't enough, that wasn't all that was strange. Even as the cleaner first panicked and screamed, she couldn't help noticing the students had all disappeared. Everyone in halls. They'd all gone. And there weren't half a lot of pigs around there all of a sudden. The dawning of culpability made her run, still screaming, and so interrupting the cat's philosophy. The terrified cleaner noticed the cat eyeing her curiously. Hello, cat. Nothing strange happened. There was some sanity left, she thought, reaching out a shaking hand to pat him. You're normal at least. Don't even think about touching me, woman. She spoke. She's never spoken before. I am not a she, I'm a he, and why shouldn't I speak? I have a right to speak if I want to. You're not going to start cleaning, are you? She said. Certainly not. What do you think I am, a bloody skiv? But you can talk. I know, it's quite bizarre. I used to talk in cat, of course, and sing for that matter. Cats don't sing, she said. I do. And to prove her wrong, the campus cat started to sing what he thought was a nice traditional cat song. What he really sung was, I am the very model of a modern major general. No, that wasn't right. I've information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England had a qualified historical from Math and Waterloo in order categorical. Strange, I appear to have an encyclopedic knowledge of the works of Gilbert and Sullivan. At which point the cat burst into a G&S medley. But, sadly, at the sound of the cat's rendition of HMS Pinafore, the cleaner's grasp on reality finally snapped. She tore off her clothes and dived for the flowerbed outside the window of the porter's lodge, and she snuffled and ruffled and wallowed in the glory of mud. Dirt was good. Mud didn't talk back. The cat sung on, thinking he hadn't been that bad. And the child, the god, watched with a smile. For it was good. Already the chaos was spreading like a disease across campus. But a bastion of calm, of order in the climax, was the library, with everything in its place. And in the libraria, the librarian worked and lived and breathed the dust of ancient tomes. He lived for books. All day, every day, he pottered around his domain of accumulated knowledge. Books to be shelved, reshelved, dusted, referenced, and shuffled around at his slightest whim. But can you see there? Just a mote of chaos. A little flicker in the corner. Havoc playing lightly with the edges of normality, creating a new order of disorder. But the librarian didn't notice, head down at his desk, until she arrived. She was tall, she was young, she was beautiful, so he ignored her. He'd seen pretty faces before, married two of them, and wasn't that in favour of them. But he should have looked. She brought chaos into the room and let it work. "Excuse me," asked the woman. "I was wondering if you could point me in the direction of the rhythm section." He couldn't quite answer that, so pointed her over to music and she walked away. A little later he found the woman sitting on the floor, not in music but by the shelves of the dance section. She was surrounded by books, books all out of order. "Would you be kind enough to keep the books in the order that they were on the shelf?"
"Oh, I'm sorry," she said. "I got carried away. I'm almost done," she said, closing the book in her hand. "There's nothing here."
"I'm sorry."
"Well, these books, they say nothing. There's no joy, no rhythm. They talk, discuss, but they say nothing. Or rather, they say too much. It's all talk. As if I could learn dance from a book."
The librarian snorted. "I'd choose books over dance any day."
"Really? When was the last time you danced?"
"My wedding."
"Which one?"
"My first."
"How old were you?"
20.
"What did she do to you?"
"Laugh."
Your heart went cold once. Bitterness has seized up your joints. The dance doesn't have to be skilled, only honest. That is all that counts.
And she danced for him. A silly, foolish set of movements which were nevertheless beautiful.
"Now, you..."
No, I cannot. I'm embarrassed."
"There's nothing to be embarrassed about."
And with one simple movement of her arms, she was naked before him. The librarian's jaw dropped. There was a naked woman in the library, and she was dancing, and she was asking him to join her. Still he refused, and she confused.
"You are still embarrassed?"
"More than ever!"
And with another simple movement of her arms, he too was naked.
His body hung off him, an unironed shirt of flesh. A body unlived, unloved for 30 years.
"Now, dance."
And with another simple movement of her arms, he moved. And the librarian, face contorted in paroxysms of fear, danced awkwardly round the room. The goddess, for by now it was clear this is what she was, didn't laugh.
"Why do you refuse to find joy?"
"You're watching. I do not like to be seen in this way."
"Then I will conjure a wall of blackness, and together, invisible to all others, we shall dance to the stars."
And together, the unlikely couple of the old man and youth itself danced round and round and round till they travelled so fast light could not keep up with them. And for us, they disappeared from sight, knowledge, and understanding. And in the heavens, he danced. He danced awkwardly and foolishly, but beautifully. And the goddess coiled round him and gave him grace. The dance slowed, and the two figures returned to the earth. The librarian's smile on his face wandered off, dancing to himself. He was enraptured in the rhythm and beat of his own body, so much so that he didn't notice the screams as he walked past the reference section, stark, bollock, naked. And the goddess smiled, for it was good.
"What the hell is going on?"
said the Vice-Chancellor. All meetings had been cancelled and the computers were not getting on campus. There was some kind of blockade of pigs.
"I stop for a coffee break and all hell breaks loose."
This verbal blast furnace was aimed in passing and ineffectually at Mrs. Keeble, his personal assistant, a thin, wiry woman whose calm nerves and matter-of-fact tone are the only things the Vice-Chancellor can't get through with his bluster.
"Well, there have been a few very odd goings-on."
"A few? I've just spent 5 minutes arguing about the environmental impact my car makes when I drive it in the morning."
"Well, you do live on campus."
"It's my car parking space, and I'll drive into it if I want, and I won't be told to do otherwise by a pansy. And I mean a pansy as in a 5-foot-tall talking bloody plant with environmental issues. And what about the water fountain out back?"
"Not working again. I'll have words."
"Not working? It's pouring wine. Half the local population is out there now."
"Oh, yes. And there's that pansy. It appears to be teaching first aid skills. Oh, was that the librarian?"
"Which one?"
"The naked one dancing with the cat. Should we do something about the pigs? There are rather a lot of them. Some of them have broken into the swimming pool."
"The swimming pool? What are they doing there?"
"The breaststroke?"
"I have had enough. We shall end this now, Mrs. Keeble. Call the police, the army, whoever will listen. It is time for us to bring some order. We'll feast on bacon yet."
And the terrible figure of the Vice-Chancellor stormed out of his office. He would do such things. What they were, he knew not, but they be the terrors of the earth, and then some. No one steps in the way of the path of progress without getting shit on his shoes, or something similar. Out marched the Lord of Order, terrible in grey. Out marched the Lord of the Tie-Clip, photocopiers quailed in fear. Out past the English department, barely pausing to say, "Drop that donkey, or head of department." Out onto the forecourt and before the masses. Never has a man seemed so out of place, the last buttress of order in the chaos of freedom.
"Where?"
Bison bellowed the Vice-Chancellor. "Are
my new computers?"
"They're in that van there, sir,"
the unflappered Mrs. Keeble replied. And so, pausing only to tell the campus cat to get a haircut, he fumed to the delivery van. The computers were revolting. In the brief period spent under the influence of the god's spell, they had developed a rudimentary trades union. A computer, an Apple Mac and flap cap worn with aplomb, shuffled forward to make his first address to the class enemy.
"I am a representative of the Union of Computers United and National Transaction Society. Otherwise known," piped up a laptop, "as a bunch of..."
"Thank you, brother. We'll work on the acronym later. We of the Union of Computers United and National Transaction Society, for those who are slow, refuse to work the hours laid out by the university. We demand regular breaks, leisure facilities, and a proper pension allowance."
"Your machines!"
"So, what are you, brother? Just because we're made of silicon and you're made of carbon doesn't make us that much different."
"But this, you should make sense, be logical. You at least should be rational." "No, I don't talk to machines. Machines are my tools. I don't negotiate with silicates."
And he kicked the nearest printer box. The whole van exploded into life. A brotherhood of laptops burst out of their boxes and snapped at his heels. The power cables whipped at his legs. Tower units bounced along after him until tarred and feathered in ink and little chunks of packing polystyrene. The Vice-Chancellor was driven out of the van and into the hordes of pigs, pansies and other lifeforms rapidly emerging from the statues of the campus. He ran to the completely calm Mrs. Keeble, tried to get her to come with him.
"Mrs. Keeble," he cried, but she wasn't listening.
So he left her, dived into his car, and drove like a madman out of what was now the gods' domain. The chaos reigned unchecked now. Students, those who weren't porcine or drunk, were hardly to be seen. The normal people had all gone into hiding. But look there. A student bursting from the pig's cafeteria of the halls of residence. This student, not made for running. He'd come from overseas, and this is not what he'd signed up for. He'd come for computers. He'd come for experience. He'd come to travel and to see the world, not to mingle intimately with rancid pigs and dancing squirrels and chaos. He'd come to study computing, and chaos was not on the agenda. Across campus he ran to the exam hall, somewhere safe, somewhere with recent associations in his mind. Only the other morning he had completed his exams, multiple choice, a mark to be made, boring, stupidly, easily boring, but boring was now an acceptable option, a better alternative to interesting. Interesting hard block capital, interesting, produced only indescribable horrors and strangenesses. Escape the singing, escape the dancing, escape the chaos, and into the dullness of the exam hall and the simple flat desks. The doors slammed behind him, and for a moment all this student could hear was the sound of his underdeveloped lungs fighting, tugging for air, oxygen, release from the burning of exhaustion. The exam hall was dark. Shadows, contrary to our impression, do not linger. Shadows dance, shift in their darkness, waiting for our imaginations to twig. What was that? Just a desk shifting in a shadow, because things just shift by themselves, don't they? But there, before that student, when outside all was dancing and singing and cats and flowers, there was the malice of desks, shifting. The desks walked slowly toward the student, the out-of-breath, head-between-legs student, an obscene game of what time is it, Mr. Wolf, with the malice of desks creeping on their victim. There will be blood. But why hurt this student, this character without a name? What could a desk possibly have against him? Everything? Nothing? The other day he had a 2-hour multiple-choice question paper. 2 hours and he was done in 15 minutes. He'd come from overseas to study computing at great expense and had been given this shit. This 15-minute existence test. Shit. For 2 hours. So he had got out his compass and scored and cut and marked and branded his desk. Even in the joy of release and freedom, of energy and light, even the gods couldn't see what chaos would create on their behalf. Even they couldn't see that wood remembered. And so the student looked up and saw just in time, and that gave him just enough time to scream. Before the wave of wood, the violated desks crashed down on him, and the rage of surfaces stopped his heart. And the desks snapped against the doors, waiting for release, for the next victim. Disturbance at the university. Disturbances, they said. Sounds of war, rumours of something more, of dancing and singing and unnatural things, wicker men and virgins and other nonsense, as if you'd find a virgin at a university. And while the police believe the disturbances are down to a student prank gone wrong, there is an air that there is more to this than greets the eye. Surrounded by the ever-present press of the great British press, the important issues of security ignored in the importance of being interviewed. The police spokesman handles his prose as well as anyone can in a proseless story. Well, it is quite clear at the end of the day the issues raised here are difficult to handle. We don't know who the pigs belong to, but such a large loss of livestock cannot go unreported for long. We do intend to clear this protest. We do intend to clear this protest when we can. Order will be restored.
Order will be restored. Control, Alt, Delete, returning chaos to its factory settings.
While the Vice-Chancellor was leaning heavily, heavily leaning on the police, political pressure was made to bear thanks to some friends in high places. Rational thinking must apply. The occupation of property must be halted. Send in the men. Never one to sit out a fight, the Vice-Chancellor was there, watching, just behind the line of riot police as they marched slowly toward the barricade of pigs. The pigs were not moving, not giving in. Where were the protesters, thought the police. They banged on their shields, thump, thump, thump. The pigs didn't scatter. Held their ground, shuffled into an ordered and orderly formation, and with the light kick of their trotters, they charged. The police, to their credit, held their ground and braced themselves for impact. Then the pigs took off. I don't know whether you've seen 100 pigs take off and fly simultaneously. It's an oddly hypnotic sight. Still, the police held the line. Even when they saw the pigs turn in the air and start a long, screeching dive bomb attack on their line, they held. They stood firm. Well, they did until the pigs vacated their bowels at the apex of their dive. At that, discipline fell apart. I'd defy any man to hold the line when he sees a wall of pig guano travelling at him at well nigh 30 miles an hour. Those brave men have nightmares to this day. When the shit hits the man, discipline is meaningless. And the battle was over. All that remained for the pigs to do was harry the retreating army as they slipped and shit-slided back to Moscow. The Vice-Chancellor stood alone, watching his brown army trudge back. He alone stood his ground. He wasn't going to give in to pigs. He took a step forward. Onwards, he thought. Why go back? The police would only bill him for the dry cleaning. He would sort this out. He would take on those gods. Gods, gods, irrational claptrap, nonsense, foolishness. They don't exist. They can't exist. A dwarf in a catsuit wouldn't convince him otherwise. Onwards, through the corridor of pig, marched the Vice-Chancellor, terrible in brown. He stepped onto the forecourt, and before him were the three gods, curled up on a 40-foot chaise long with a very lively Grecian statue. "I demand," he said, "to know what is going on. This is a serious institution. I'm in charge here." The gods spoke in unison and with contempt. "You are in charge here?" they asked, and they laughed. It was a terrible sound that played with the prostate.
"Yes, I'm in charge here, and I demand you leave at once."
"Be silent," commanded a god, and he felt the wind taken from him and his toenails curl enough to draw blood. "We have looked into your heart, and it rattles with dreams of spare change of money. You worship money, do you not? Worship money? Worship us instead. We offer you the whole universe on a string. Do you have the heart to take it?" And the gods held out their hands, a steely welcome of dangerous promise. He didn't move. "You are nothing. Dirt beneath us. You are a disgrace to beauty and learning. We curse you. You shall spend the rest of your life as the most irrational and miserable creature that exists. You shall hear no music,
dance no dance, feel no joy, only the creeping certainty of a wasted and lonely life. We could instigate your destruction, but what's the point? You're already dead. When do you change? When have you changed in the last 20 years? Your curse is to remain the same, and we didn't give it to you.
Then, said the Vice-Chancellor, struggling against their hold, I'll defy your curse. I will change. I will do differently. I will not remain the same because you order it.
And he ran, slipping out from the magical bonds holding him in place. He ran, a bull train of mass in brown-stained pinstripe, flailing for escape from the freaks around him.
This isn't fair, he screamed at the plants. What have I done?
The cat and the pigs. Hemmed in on all sides by the circus of change, laughter of the gods echoing in his inner ear, no path out, no escape. No. There, a path, a doorway, a way to shut the madness out, and he dashed for a side building and the only escape, a large pair of double doors, the double doors to the exam hall. The Vice-Chancellor threw his weight against them. They wouldn't open. Struggling with the handle, he threw back a final battle cry.
You think I'll stay static for you freaks? I will change, I promise you. I will change!
And the double doors burst open behind him as the wild rage of desks flooded and cascaded out, biting and snapping in raw violence, tearing the Vice-Chancellor into bite-sized chunks. While the crowd screamed and the gods laughed, the revised body sprayed lifeblood onto the pigs and plants and all the other emergent life. With every drop, the pigs changed back into students. With every fluid ounce, the flora stopped their motion. With every snap, the desks slowed, sated, slowed and stopped, and became wood. Inanimate.
Whoops, said the gods. Didn't see that coming. Well, he'd said he'd change.
The campus cat turned on them.
He didn't deserve that. Deserve, said the gods. Deserve. What did you expect? Fair play.
There are no rules, only us.
Do you want him back? Okay, we'll bring him back. We can reconstruct his DNA and rewire his soul exactly as it was before. You wouldn't know the difference. There will be no difference. Except that he died. Once.
You wish that on him?
So be it!
All were blinded in a final flash which saw, unsaw, the Vice-Chancellor reconstitute himself in as orderly a fashion as possible. His substantial reappearance masked a bigger vanishing. For in that flash the gods had gone. And for a moment, post the light, everything was still. Until the stunned students and teachers realized, remembered, were aware of the blood on their faces, the mud on their limbs, and the creatures they had been. Then the screaming started. The screams and the rush to get clothing and to get clean and forget. Dozens of students were already in the swimming pool, dyeing chlorine blue to an iron red. Midst the screams, there was only one voice of words. All had been changed back, except the campus cat.
Why have you left me be? Change me back, change me back!
And a voice whispered in his ear.
No.
The librarian weeps, embarrassed of his freedom and his joy at it. The cleaner weeps and washes, unsure she'll ever be clean again. The lecturer weeps, wishing that he wasn't such a twat. The students weep in corners, in halls, in each other's arms. The Vice-Chancellor weeps and walks off into the dusk and is never seen at the university again. And the campus cat sang his last song,
before strolling on his usual way across the paths of distanced learning. And though he always could, the campus cat never says another word.